ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Drums, flutes, and rattles are the foundation of Native American music and a ubiquitous part of many Native gatherings. Some musicians have elevated their mastery of those instruments to new levels of artistry and expression. Meanwhile, the craftspeople who make the instruments are also highly skilled. We'll hear about unique Native instruments and the people who make and play them coming up after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says Health Secretary Robert Kennedy has pledged to preserve the Indian Health Service. She says she reached Kennedy by phone last weekend.
He was given a mandate to make a 10% reduction across the board throughout health and social services. And after we had our conversation, he committed to me that there were going to be no reductions at IHS, Indian Health Services, on his watch. It was important to have that line of communication.
Murkowski voted for Kennedy's confirmation despite her disapproval of his decades-long campaigns to undermine trust in vaccines. She defended that vote by saying she has to find a way to work with top officials in the Trump administration to represent her constituents' concerns. And she says Kennedy's IHS pledge shows her approach is already paying off. Meanwhile, Congresswoman Shelley Pingree and Senator Jeff Merkley, ranking Democratic members on subcommittees that oversee funding for the Department of the Interior, are urging the Trump administration to reinstate terminated Indian Affairs employees. They're also calling for the federal hiring freeze to be lifted and to rescind early retirement offers. In a letter sent to Interior Secretary Doug Burgum Thursday, the lawmakers asked the administration to instead work to strengthen and grow Indian Affairs staff to best meet the needs of American Indians and Alaska Natives. They say many of the Indian Affairs programs tribal communities rely on are already underfunded and understaffed, and that the administration's actions are damaging, implemented without tribal consultation, and put vital Indian Country services at risk. Wisconsin tribal nations are working toward energy autonomy. They're using renewable energy and creating economic opportunities, as Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
Tribal nations have historically faced challenges to own and control their own electricity, even though a significant number of plant and utility infrastructure are in close proximity to reservation lands. Isaiah Ness founded Sunbear Industries after witnessing disproportionate opportunities in the renewable energy space.
There's not much disparity in the type of person that was receiving solar. It was one of those things that you could see the common trend very easily.
Ness now helps indigenous and minority communities in Wisconsin to build renewable energy infrastructure with an emphasis on intersecting cultural appreciation and economic opportunities. The Menominee Nation is working to achieve energy sovereignty by 2035. Part of that vision began with their Solar Elder Project, which was created to ensure elder community members are never without power during outages. Ness says reservations typically have high power demands, and having autonomy over that is key.
It makes more sense for them to have on-reservation power-producing plants and facilities that are also sourced from clean energy, and then for them to be able to reinvest into their own community. And so this concept of a virtuous cycle is seeing how far and how many cycles can we make out of $1 that is injected into renewable energy.
Community partnerships and grants have been a crucial component to the progress indigenous communities have made thus far. The Inflation Reduction Act allocated about $400 billion toward climate initiatives, with a large portion dedicated to renewable energy projects through tax incentives and grants for tribes. Uncertainty looms on whether programs like these will be included in proposed spending cuts under the Trump administration. I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
DT Track, your healthcare partner, provides access to a nationwide network of qualified healthcare temporary staff, including medical billing professionals that optimize your revenue cycles. More at dt-track.com who support this show. Support provided by First National Bank Alaska, offering a one-solution, tailored approach to meet the financial needs of Alaskans by providing banking services, loans, investments, and more to help shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Drums, rattles, and other percussion instruments are well-known sources of musical accompaniment in indigenous music and tradition. And there are a variety of melodic instruments, including flutes, fiddles, and harps, that are specific to certain tribes and represent a very important part of culture and ceremony. In many communities, making instruments is an art form itself, perfected over generations. In this hour, we'll explore more about traditional instruments, the people who make them, and the ways they are incorporated in contemporary compositions. As always, you can join us. What musical instruments are unique to your people and community? What instruments do you most enjoy hearing in songs and ceremonies? We're at 1-800-996-2848. Do you make instruments? Call us at 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's now meet today's guests. Joining us from Lakemont, Georgia is William Rodriguez. He's the owner of Archaic Roots and an indigenous instruments specialist. He is Taino. William, hello, and welcome to Native America Calling.
Takahi. Hello, how's it going?
I'm doing well, doing well. Thanks for asking. Joining us from Kingman, Arizona is Bennett Wakayuda. He's a Wallapai and Hopi artist. Bennett, hello to you as well. Welcome to the show.
Good to meet you. Bennett Wakayuda Muya, Wamuk Baja.
Thank you, Bennett. Joining us from Anchorage, Alaska is Andrew Weaver. He's a program coordinator for the Alaska Native Heritage Center. He is Yupik. Good morning, Andrew. Welcome.
Waka.
From ceramics, we also make other instruments as well, you know, as you know, like rattles, which are pretty commonplace across most cultures. And then one of our most sacred instruments is the wamo, the conch shell trumpet, which is basically the most important instrument in our ceremonial collection.
Now, each one of these instruments, is there a specific role for each?
For Taino, I think probably the guamo, the conch shell trumpet, is probably the most important. We open ceremonies, close ceremonies, call to the ancestors and spirits, things like that with the guamo. Probably the conch shell trumpet is probably the most important. And then, of course, you know, the other instruments like rattles and things like that are always important and pretty cross-cultural for most tribal peoples. So they're going to be used in ceremonies as well. Those are a few instruments that Taino people specialize in.
Well, let's hear what the conch shell trumpet sounds like. Here's a little audio piece that you shared with our producers. There it is. Very, very unique, William. Tell us, how do you get that type of sound, that tone?
So each conch shell is different, and they come in different sizes. And depending on the size and the age of the conch, the tone can be different. You're basically playing the conch shell trumpet like a trumpet, or kind of like a didgeridoo with a vibrating your lips inside the mouthpiece. I specialize in carving the conch shells with different designs from our culture, from semis, which are like spirits or ancestors, symbolic of spirits or ancestors. I also have a specialty in making wooden mouthpieces for the trumpets that makes it easier to play, and kind of goes off of other cultures adding wooden mouthpieces to their conch shells.
Now, of course, this is a radio show, so people can't see images right now unless they go to our website. But can you describe a little bit about how this instrument appears?
So basically it's just a conch shell. And at the very most primitive form, I guess, is just a conch shell. One of my ancestors may have found on the beach. And basically you would just smash the apex part, the pointed end of the conch shell. You kind of smash the end off, open it up so you can actually blow into it. And you would use a rock or something like that to smooth it out so it won't hurt your lips. And basically it just looks like a big conch shell. Like, many people probably understand what a conch shell looks like because it's pretty common to eat conch or conch, depending on how you want to pronounce it, in the Caribbean and other places around. And you can find these conch shell trumpets in cultures everywhere from the Mayans, Polynesian people, all the way to Asia, Japan. Basically, even in Tibet, they have found conch shell trumpets that have been imported. So they're pretty cross-cultural in general.
I like how you pronounce it. I'm going to continue to pronounce it as conch shell going forward. That sounds good. And William, we heard that brief audio piece. I imagine that you can make multiple sounds, though, different pitches perhaps and tones with the instrument?
Yeah, there's a couple different ways. You know, you either can add pressure, or there's actually, you can add finger holes to the conch that will change the note, kind of similar to how a flute works. And basically, though, it's the size and age, thickness of the shell that determines the fundamental note of the conch. And then there's a few different variations of blowing harder or softer or adding a finger hole to change the note. But other than that, it's basically the size and the age of the shell which determines the fundamental note.
Walk us through the process of when you're making one of these instruments and you're working with them. What kind of images do you envision of your ancestors and other people, family, friends, community?
Yeah, making instruments in general, indigenous instruments in general, kind of brings back this genetic memory, I guess, is the best way to explain it. It kind of honors our ancestors and our tribal ways as best as we can in this modern world. Especially as Taino people, we were the first to be colonized by the Europeans, the first to rebel against the Spanish. So we lost a ton of our culture in that process. So just to be able to make instruments, in a manner similar as our ancestors, it just brings me closer to my culture, my people, the connection to all Native people in general. I really enjoy just making all kinds of instruments, and I like educating people about instruments. Where I live, Native people aren't really known too much about our culture or really anything. So I like to go to the schools, different groups, Boy Scouts, things like that, and educate them on things that they may not understand, and that is also another way of, you know, honoring our cultures, all of our cultures across the board.
Now, have you taught other people how to make conch shell trumpets?
Yeah, that's one of my main things. I'm a musician, but I don't really record music. So really through my business, I am either making custom ceremonial instruments or teaching people how to make their own instruments. With shells, it's a little different because it's one of the most dangerous things that you can actually work on, the natural materials. Breathing in the shell dust is very bad for you. And then depending on the shell, sometimes they can carry heavy metals, which can go through your skin, things like that. So that's not really an instrument I really teach people how to make in person. I have done like tutorials online about it, but it's a very dangerous material to work with. But I teach people how to, make wooden flutes, ceramic flutes, rattles, drums of all kinds, from African drums to native drums. So I really enjoy that educational part of everything.
I can tell. I can tell by the way you describe it. You love what you do. What about the tools that you use to fashion and fabricate these instruments? Are any of these tools from a traditional type of history, or do they have any type of significance in and of themselves?
So, when I was younger, I used a lot of primitive tools and hand working and things like that. But as I've gotten older, I've realized that, sometimes it's better to kind of take up the modern technology. So now my workshop has, a lot of modern tools, tile saws for cutting the shells, Dremel tools for carving, things like that. Now, traditionally, I still would use sometimes, if it's like a highly valued ceremony tool that the person who's using it doesn't want any mechanical machine tools used, then yes, I would use, simple hand saws, chisels, things like that. But like I said, the Taino people, our culture was almost decimated. So we're in this like resurgence process, and we don't have really too much direct connection to exactly which tools we were using, and we don't have this unbroken line of how things were done for everything. So I've resorted, as I've gotten older, to use mechanical tools for the most part.
William, thank you for kicking off our conversation today on Native America Calling. We're learning about indigenous musical instruments, and after this break, we're going to hear from Bennett Wakayuda, who joins us from Kingman, Arizona. So stay with us. The people who work to repatriate important items keep a constant vigil on behalf of all Native Americans. They have to maintain contacts with government officials and museum staffs to repair centuries of damaging disregard in the name of academic study. On the eve of the biggest annual conference of repatriation advocates, we'll get updates on pressing repatriation issues. That's on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
You're listening to Native America Calling. We're talking with indigenous musicians and instrument makers today. We just learned about conch shell trumpets used by the Taino people. What musical instruments or materials to make those instruments are unique to your native community? Let us know. Call us, 1-800-996-2848. We've got the phone lines open. Let's get some calls going and hear from some listeners. 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's now talk with Bennett Wakayuda, who is a Wallapai and Hopi artist. Bennett, you are a drum maker. How did you learn your craft?
Oh, man, I learned it on accident. I barely got a job with the Wallapai Cultural Resources Department in 2010, and that was after a river trip that changed my life. Once I started with the cultural department, you know, the ladies on there happened to be part of the staff, the director of that department, and then they had seen a carving that I did, because I used to just be nothing but a Hopi Kachina carver, and they saw it. They asked if I could share how to carve. I said, I won't share how to carve a kachina, but I'll share how to, you know, whittle something. And so that got my foot in the door with the culture department. And then at the same time, there was an elder there that is my uncle. But he turned out to be one of my biggest teachers, especially in the drum society world. And he seems to always be mad at me, you know, always looking for something to get mad at. And, you know, I went through this with him for my first couple of years, you know, like 4 or 5 years. And we had to do a cultural arts and language class together for the community. And the second year I went down the river again, I found a naturally hollowed shell, a log, a cottonwood log, and I picked it up. And then when we got picked up from Drake, you know, he came up to me as, oh, man, why did the river give you, you know, all these gifts and stuff? Because, you know, I was the young guy, and this is an elder. And, you know, there's that mentality, like, what does this guy know? You know, and but, you know, it went like that. And he says, now I got to teach you how to make a drum. And that year also happened to be the year that I started hunting. So my first kill was an elk. And so our first class was actually a butchering class with that elk. And that elk went to the community that was there. Everybody had all went, it was all distributed. And that's, you know, what we do. Our first kill goes to the community. With that hide, we used that as our drum making class. And before we even started that class, we were already working on the shells. You know, he had brought in some wood. I already had mine out, and I was just filing the inside to, you know, make it thinner, the walls thinner. And then the rest of the class, we're just using stumps, and we're just blowing embers through to make the hole. And he kept on, you know, just giving me instructions. He would, like, come in one day and say, all right, go out there and dig a pit. We need to get the hair off these hides. You know, dig a pit about 4 feet down, 4 feet wide. And he'd come out, then, you know, he'll look at it and say, okay, that's pretty good. Did you pray? And I'm just like, no, huh? And then just shake his head, walk away, and go home or something. I don't know where he went, but that's how it went. You know, he would always come in, just be mad at some. And then, you know, it was to where I was, like, teaching that class for, like 4 years. 4 years later, he came in. He cornered me, and I thought he was going to say something. But he said, Bennett, I've been watching you. You never talked back. You always did what I said. You know, you listened. You always took the class over. This is, you know, this is our way of seeking. You know, you guys, your generation, they didn't have to seek, not the way I did. You know, those ways aren't even around anymore, hardly. Mm-hmm. But I've been watching you, so now you're the drum maker. And he made me cry, you know, hair stands up on my arm still, just goosebumps just thinking about it, because That was probably the most emotional time and connection that I've ever had with him. And then you started just saying, you know, this is how we teach. You know, this is how you have to wait. You can't just push somebody to be your student. And, you know, it made me cry. So that's how I became the drum maker. And everything started with the hunt. Everything that involves everything for our people was traditionally taught. You know, the hunting part, we had to go out, look for tobacco, go clean ourselves and sweat, you know, all these protocols before we even started hunting. And then, you know, the drum shells. So it's about a year-long process, especially when we're harvesting. There's a certain times that we have to harvest certain things to use. So, you know, everything was slow, but it was cultural. And, you know, I became the teacher. And the main part, the main lesson from all of it was the prayer. I learned to pray for everything I've done. And everything came back to me in a good way.
It sure sounds like it did, Bennett. What a story. Amazing. I love hearing stories like this. And then the type of tough love, mentorship that you received as well. I think that resonates with so many of us as Native people. Well, tell us more about this process for making your drums. And do you focus on a particular kind of drum?
Something that could be a little bit wide to where, you know, it could be heard in a community, but something that it's not too heavy. Ours aren't like the powwow style drums, even though I have made a few of those. But, you know, we have one drum singer. So he's holding his drum. You know, he's either in a chair sitting or he's, you know, got it latched around his shoulders, you know, to where he could hold it and drum at the same time. So that's what I look for. I always just use cottonwood, and you know, the hides are, we're a hunting tribe, you know, so our duty in one of our creation stories was the deer. So, you know, we utilize the deer, and in our area, we're in the west rim of the Grand Canyon. So the elk were introduced in the 70s. So, but we have the same word almost for deer, which is guac. So guacta is just the bigger deer, which means elk. And so we utilize the elk in the same way. And I just love the deeper tones that the elk provide. The deer is more of a twanger, high-pitched tone. But, you know, the kids, when we teach, you know, the kids get to play with fire. Kids are young, you know. They're like 8 years old when they come to these classes. And they're playing with fire. They're playing with knives, you know, to finish fleshing off some of the hide. And, you know, we get dirty, and they get their hands dirty. And it's always a good time. We get smelly. But, you know, one of the lessons that Drake also told us was never – you know, say ooh, or, you know, pretend like that smell is a bad thing, because that smell is a smell of success. You know, it's feeding the people. It's providing an instrument for the songs that we want to sing or need to sing to a lot of places in the canyon. You know, it's the heartbeat of the land.
Bennett, what can you tell us about the songs that your drums are used for? Are they specific songs to the Hualapai people?
There's a lot of Hualapai songs, but I don't know them. I'm not a fluent Hualapai speaker. I'm learning. That's what. And when I was learning, I was a teacher. It was crazy, you know. But a lot of the songs that I do have been able to pick up were, you know, mainly songs that were taught to me in sweat. And, those I only sing them in sweat or when we're going down through the canyon that's remnants of our old people, you know, so we sing those songs back to them, You know, we lived a nomadic life to where in the summertime we would be living down there in the Colorado River where the deer went, and then the deer would move up to the higher ground in the wintertime, so we followed them. So, you know, that nomadic lifestyle, you know, had songs on in the canyon and then on top of the in the rim. So, you know, I try to respect those songs to, you know, not sing them out publicly. They do serve a special purpose. And those are, you know, with the drum songs and some of our chord songs.
Bennett, really appreciate you sharing all of this knowledge, all of these insights with our listeners today. Bennett Wakayuda, a Wallapai and Hopi drum maker. If you'd like to join the conversation, maybe you make instruments yourself, or maybe you just admire what goes into making a traditional instrument, give us a call. We want to hear your story. We'd like listeners to participate in the conversation. The number is 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. We got the phone lines open, so if you call now, we'll get your call right through. We'll bring you on the air. Let's hear now from another drum maker. This is Andrew Weaver, who joins us from Anchorage, Alaska. He's with the Alaska Native Heritage Center. And Andrew, the drums you make, they are Yupik-style drums. They're very different from the ones that Bennett makes and he described. Tell us more about your drums.
So our drums, they are traditionally made out of carved out pieces of driftwood, because where I come from, we do not have an abundance of trees because of the permafrost that is underneath the ground. So we harvest the driftwood, we carve them into really, really thin strips of pieces. We soak them in water and we steam bend them into the circular shape. And once the drum frame is made, you then carve out a really, really nice thin groove in the side of the frame. And that's how you tie the material that goes on top, which would traditionally be the stomach lining of a seal, a walrus, or the liver membrane of a whale. And you carve out your handle and you attach it to the drum frame near the bottom. And nowadays, you know, we have the luxury of having places like Lowe's or Home Depot, and we get our pieces of wood from there. And we still go through the same process of carving it really into a really thin strip, and it still goes into the water to soak, and you steam bend it. But we have molds that we can clamp our pieces of wood down onto, giving us a really, really nice circular shape. One of the only differences is, instead of utilizing the stomach lining of a seal or a walrus, is we now utilize outdoor waterproof materials. And one of those being ripstop nylon, which we can get from a fabric store, or we also utilize two-ply Ultrex, which is personally my favorite material because it gives off a really, really nice sound.
Well, speaking of the sound, Andrew, let's hear how you use your Yupik-style drum. I want to play a song that you sent to our producers. Could you tell us what we're going to hear, and then we'll go ahead and play it?
Yes. So the song that is going to be presented is one that I made just like 2 days ago, and it's about going down the river, and this little seal is circling around our boat.
All right, let's take a listen.
Quichko on ma va daya gatanga, quichko on ma va daya gatanga, isugi kiama tanha yona. Vaganga khayanga ayangiya ayanga ayangiya ayanga ayangiya ye te quicko on mava daya gatanga quicko mava taya gadanga isuge kya ma tanha yona viva ganga ayang ayang iyam ayang ayang iyam ayang ayang iyam yeah.
Ah, beautiful, Andrew. Just awesome, really. Tell us more. Like, what are some of the other settings in which your drums are played?
So we have weekly dance practices that happens at our local hospital. It's called the Alaska Native Medical Center, and that's like a central area where our dance groups, they get together and they provide like a sense of healing for the patients that are receiving care from rural Alaska. And we do host potlatches that are hosted in the springtime. So most of our rural areas or rural villages will be hosting their potlatches.
And what do you hear from, like, I'm envisioning you going, and I've been to that hospital there in Anchorage. I know it's a huge complex. How do the patients respond when you come in and you play?
We always get really, really good responses from our patients. They always come up to the drummers and they tell us what you guys are doing is very healing and it makes me miss home.
All right. Andrew, we're going to take another break. We'll be back, though, and just on the other side of this break, and we'll continue the conversation. And we've got a lot more to talk about with regard to these traditional instruments, indigenous instruments, the people who make them, the people who play them. We've got a guest on the show from Hawaii who's going to talk about ukuleles as well. So stay with us, and please join the conversation as well. The phone lines are still open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. If you don't want to call, you can always connect with us using social media as well. Facebook, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky. We've got all the options. We've also got our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. That'll work too. Engage with us here on the show. Let us hear your thoughts. We want to hear from your community. 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Trickster Cultural Center hosts the 11th Annual National Gathering of American Indian Veterans to honor veterans and military personnel of all cultures, eras, and branches in a Native way. Trickster Cultural Center's National Gathering of American Indian Veterans is open to the public at no charge Friday, July 18th and Saturday, July 19th in Schaumburg, Illinois. More at tricksterculturalcenter.org/national-gathering-2025. Trickster Cultural Center supports this show.
When you file online for your Permanent Fund Dividend, every Alaskan can support great causes, including Native America Calling. Just use Pick, Click, Give, and select KNBA-FM, Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Through your support, you can help us make a difference in our community when you pick, click, give for causes you care about. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Program support by AmeriCorps Vista, where you can kickstart your career and help others in your community. With AmeriCorps Vista, you can serve in an office setting and address issues of poverty while gaining career experience and building your leadership skills. Learn more by visiting AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Native Forward Scholars Fund scholarships are open now. Native Forward supports Native students' higher education journeys, offering over 40 scholarship opportunities, programs, and resources designed for Native students. Info and applications at nativeforward.org, who support this show. Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. Join our discussion today about indigenous musical instruments. Do you make instruments for yourself and others in your community? Tell us about it. We're at 1-800-996-2848. On the line now is Andrew Weaver. He is a Yupik drum maker. And Andrew, before we move on to our next guest, I want to ask you, do you have a favorite drum that you have made, or is each one special in its own way?
So each one is very special in their own way. But if I had to pick one that I'm most proud of, it's this drum that's 26 inches in diameter, and it's painted with a traditional stain, which in our language we know it as witerak, and it's just like a red clay or red ochre.
Thank you, Andrew. That really helps me envision these drums that you make. And folks, check out our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com, if you'd like to learn more about our guest today and the musical instruments that they create for the benefit of their communities and others who enjoy this music. It is a gift for our listeners as well as the communities that we serve. So, Andrew, thank you for joining the show. I want to bring now Sean Yakuvone into the conversation. He's in Oahu, Hawaii. He's the owner of Ukulele Friend, co-chair of the Hawaiian Music Archives. And Sean, let's talk more about the ukulele. You pronounce it differently, though, so I'd like to hear how you pronounce it. And I know it's not indigenous to Hawaii, but it's become a huge part of Native Hawaiian culture. Give us a short history of how that happened.
Sure. It's pronounced as ukulele, and it has a beautiful history that really ties into the communities, a variety of people that came here to work in the plantation fields in the late 1800s, early 1900s. The parent instruments to the ukulele, and there are two, come from the island of Madeira, Portugal, which is actually closer to Western Africa than it is to mainland Portugal. And these two instruments, one is in the size of the smallest size of the ukulele. There are four sizes, a soprano, a concert, a tenor, and a baritone. But one of the parent instruments is in the size of the soprano, the small one. And this instrument is known as the father instrument to the ukulele. So the ukulele receives the shape and size, the scale length, all that from this that particular instrument. The second instrument is known as mother instrument to the ukulele. It's called the hajau or rajau. And that is a five-string instrument. And basically the tuning of the ukulele comes from that instrument. And so what you really have is a combination of these two instruments that made their way to Hawaii. And through a whole host of things that happened with the instrument, with things that were happening in Hawaii. So there are political influences on the evolution of the ukulele. There are geographical influences on the evolution of the ukulele. There are economical influences on the evolution of the ukulele, as well as business influences on the evolution of the ukulele. All of these things tie in. And what you have in the late 1800s is a thriving music culture here in Hawaii. But what you also have is a variety or a community of people from all sorts of different backgrounds. You have Chinese immigrants that have come to Hawaii, Japanese immigrants that have come to Hawaii, Portuguese immigrants that come to Hawaii, and of course the Native Hawaiians that live here. And so the instrument itself, in my opinion, really is an amalgamation of the community of peoples that resided in Hawaii in the late 1800s, specifically the Hawaiian king, King Kalakaua, of the Hawaiian kingdom at that time, who had advanced and taken interest in the instrument, had promoted this instrument along with native, Hawaiian language and culture and hula and all of these things. But the ukulele was of interest there. So you have kind of these this interest by the Hawaiian kingdom, but you also have the Madeirans who brought the parent instruments. You have the Chinese, the Filipinos, the Japanese are all living in Hawaii that embraced this instrument. And yet it's at a time in Hawaii's history with tremendous turmoil with the overthrow of the Hawaiian government in 1897. So you know, it's really a time of difficulty, but through that, something so beautiful as the ukulele emerges.
Well, speaking of Hawaiian leaders from the late 1800s, I'd like to play a little bit of ukulele music, and you actually recorded a local musician, Kuana Torres Kahele, and he starts this audio out introducing the song. It's called Kaulana Napua.
The song I'm going to do is a song entitled Hemele Ai Pohaku, otherwise known as Kaulana Napua. So it's a very sad song, but it helps us Kanaka Maoli identify ourselves as Hawaiian people. Never forget, yeah? Song entitled Kaulana Napua, Hemele Ai Pohaku.
That song, it just like hits me like a cool island breeze, brother. It just really, really, really sounds beautiful. Tell us more about the ukulele that's being played in that clip.
The ukulele in that particular clip is the earliest known example of an ukulele. It's a Hawaiian Kingdom era instrument. And if I could correct myself, I think I said 1897 by accident. I meant 1893 was the Hawaiian Kingdom overthrow. But that instrument is the earliest known example of an ukulele in existence. And so no one knows who made the first ukulele, but it is a very, very early example with a softwood top, which is actually made of fir. And the back and sides of that instrument are of a hardwood that appears to be either a Brazilian rosewood or teal, which would have been brought to Hawaii because we do not have either of those materials here.
Now, you also collect ukuleles. What are some of the instruments you have that you cherish the most?
I'm very fortunate to be the caretaker of a large collection of Hawaiian Kingdom era instruments, meaning, you know, those up until 1893. And I have a focus on everything 19th century. And so what that really means is there's only a short window, and there were multiple fires that happened during this time. So there are not many instruments out there from this time period, 19th century ukuleles, but I'm fortunate to have the largest collection that we're aware of to be able to use these instruments for educational purposes and honor our ancestors. So I'm flying around the world, repatriating these instruments, returning them to Hawaii, having them restored, sharing the sound of these instruments on original gut strings, which would have been used at the time. And so that's an exciting journey for me.
And Sean, an instrument that old, I would imagine you have to really take precautions with a piece like that. And what goes into that? Just preserving those pieces so that they'll be able to be enjoyed by future generations too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I model this after what's happening with Stradivarius instruments, and he not only made violins and violas, but also made guitars. And those instruments are several hundred years old, but they're being played and enjoyed and shared for educational purposes. And this is what I'm trying to do. It's important that these instruments be returned here. I work with professionals that are subcontracted with museums for museum restoration. And I pay for those out of my own pocket because I believe in this cause of education and celebrating the rich history and culture of our community here in Hawaii and all the people that contributed to the popularity of that instrument, not only the musicians and the makers, but the retailers, the manufacturers, the string makers, right? Everyone has a place and a story in this line with ukulele. And so I'm excited to work on this project with the Hawaii State Archives through the Hawaii Music Archives project. And it is a unique project by which we had zero ukuleles 2 years ago. We have over 1,000 now. Mm. There are 30,000 Hawaiian music recordings, some that date back to 1903. We have a string research library. All of these things are made publicly accessible at the Hawaii State Archives at Hawaiian Music at the Hawaii State Archives, which is on Iolani Palace grounds. It's a very sacred location. And so what we're doing there is allowing public access for research and educational opportunities for our community and for the broader community around the world. We've had two or three PhDs that are working on studies with ukulele and fingerstyle and different things. They've been flying down to come and go through these materials. So we want to perpetuate the culture of music, Hawaiian music, and specifically the ukulele, by having one location where everyone can come in and celebrate our history, our community, and move these things forward.
Right on. Right on. We got a couple of callers on the line. First up, Chanupa, Pine Ridge, South Dakota, listening on Kili Radio. Hello, big brother.
Hey, thank you. I want to ask both those guys this understanding, because a long time ago, my grandma Cecilia used a song for everybody, and it's all of us. And so it kind of, it went like this real fast. It went, Lechi ya ya ya, o maki ya yo yo hoi, o maki ya ye lo hei ei. Lechi ya ya hai, o maki ya yo yo hoi, a maki ya ye lo hei ei. Uchi makaya, lechi ya ya hai, O ma kia yo yo, o ma kia ye lo hey, lechi ya ya ya, o ma kia yo yo, o ma kia ye lo hey, hoy. But it was sung for her, my grandmother, her own song, because when she passed over, she shared that with people to this day. And to this day, we're using that song. Grandpa and Grandma, I want to love you guys for what you did. And Sean, that song is for a lot of them that, you know, when you pass up to your own state, they say, Wichokankile o techi ke ask, Womakan ilub hunta, takomani, takikbi he yinkti. So we'll be out to all of you in that song for everybody. Thank you all for have a good one. Okahe!
Wopulatanka, Wopulatanka, Chanupa. That's like one of the most beautiful songs I think you've sung on the show. Really, that was really, really nice, Chanupa. Thank you. Let's go now to Henry, who's listening up in Alaska on KBRW. Good morning, Henry. So glad you called in today, too.
Hey, good morning. As soon as I heard you guys are talking about dance groups and traditional dance groups, I just thought I'd call in because we're actually a well-known traditional dance group all over the world. They've been to Amsterdam, pretty much everywhere, a lot of places anyways. And we've been trying to continue to keep it alive to this day.
What kind of instruments are you folks using for your dance group?
So we have round drums made out of the loops that are made out of wood. And then we use whale liver or walrus skin, and you really could hear the difference between like how people use parachute. A lot of people do use parachute nowadays too, but we still try to keep that alive and you know, taking off the membranes and stuff from the walrus stomach could be a little time consuming, but it's well worth it. And We just actually got back from Kivik, a big dance festival up in Barrow, Alaska, Utqiagvik, and that one was a success. We've even had our kids dance and learning and everything, and it's been awesome since.
Well, Henry, thank you for calling in. Really, whale liver, that's interesting. I'm learning so much on this show today. And Andrew, I want to bring you back into the conversation because we just heard our caller, Henry, talk about a big event coming up. And before the show, you were telling me also about a dance group, an event that you're going to be participating in coming up very soon. Tell our listeners about it.
Yeah, so on the last weekend of March, me and the Alaska Native Heritage Center will be traveling to Bethel, Alaska for the Jamai Dance Festival. Yeah, it's just a dance. It's a dance festival where dance groups from the Yupik region, as well as different regions of Alaska, will gather and we share songs and dances with each other. And there actually is a very special part of the festival called the Heartbeat of the Drums, where the drummers from all dance groups, they go around the gymnasium and they beat on their drum and they sing a song. Yeah, so that's what we'll be doing.
All right. Well, good luck with that event, Andrew. And unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap up the show. We are just about out of time. So I want to thank all of our guests who joined us today, Bennett Wakayuta, William Rodriguez, Sean Yakovone, and also Andrew Weaver, enlightening us about the history and the significance of traditional Native instruments. Join us again next week when we start out with a show about important repatriation work taking place around the country. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our producers are Andy Murphy and Sol Traverso. Joe Thompson is the UNM Local News Fellow. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Sho McPolin is the digital producer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director. Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our Chief Operations Officer. The President and CEO of Kawanak Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. I'm host Sean Spruce. Have a safe weekend.
Sea Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. Sea Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Support by the American Indian College Fund. The American Indian College Fund provides millions of dollars of scholarships to thousands of Native students every year. Tribal citizens of every age and experience are eligible. The deadline for applications is May 31st, and you can find everything you need to apply at collegefund.org. That's collegefund.org, or by phone at 800-766-FUND. Education is the answer.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Ain't no hold.
everybody loves the carnival.
Oh, the carnival.
Yeah, carnival is a decent bacchanal.
Oh,